Discipline your children while there is hope. Otherwise, you will ruin their lives. Hot-tempered people must pay the penalty. If you rescue them once, you will have to do it again. Get all the advice and instruction you can, so you will be wise the rest of your life. A judge who says to the wicked, "You are innocent," will be cursed by many people and denounced by the nations. But it will go well for those who convict the guilty. Rich blessings will be showered on them. Timely advice is lovely, like golden apples in a silver basket. To one who listens, valid criticism is like a gold earring or other gold jewelry. An open rebuke is better than hidden love. Wounds from a sincere friend are better than many kisses from an enemy. In the end, people appreciate honest criticism far more than flattery. Never let loyalty and kindness leave you. Tie them around your neck as a reminder. Write them deep within your heart. Then you will find favor with both God and people, and you will earn a good reputation. Anyone who rebukes a mocker will get an insult in return. Anyone who corrects the wicked will get hurt. So don't bother correcting mockers. They will only hate you. But correct the wise, and they will love you. Instruct the wise, and they will be even wiser. Teach the righteous, and they will learn even more. A gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge appealing, but the mouth of a fool belches out foolishness. Sensible people control their temper. They earn respect by overlooking wrongs. This is God's word.
All right. Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So here's the opening question of the day. You see somebody engaging in sin. What do you do? I'm going to do some audience participation right out of the gate. What are you going to do, and how are you going to do it? We're gonna do this without a lot of groundwork on what sin is, and then I'm going to give you the longest groundwork on what sin is you've probably had in church in a long time. So just know, those are getting flipped today. And I know that if you're exploring faith, this idea of sin may be a little less settled for you. If you've become, if you've been in a community of faith, you might have a very settled view on what you think it is. And we're just going to roll with all that. We're just going to let that be while we consider a couple of scenarios, okay? Scenario number one. We're going to talk about something that most people would be comfortable categorizing as sin, okay? I'm going to use myself as the exhibit. Just last night when Michaela was going to Target, I asked her to pick me up a pack of baseball cards. This is my standard ask. She did not do that. But I like to get a pack of baseball cards from time to time. It's nostalgia for me. So imagine that you, churchgoer of the day, witnessed me at Target. And you're like, I think that's the pastor of that little church over there. And you saw me looking longingly at the baseball card section, and there was the 2026 Topps Series 2. They're like $6.99, and I was looking at one of those, and then there's the really nice pack, the chrome one, and it's like $19.99, and I'm kind of looking at that, and I'm back and forth, and I take the chrome pack, and I, boop, back pocket, and I don't know you're there, and I just stroll out of Target. What would you do? What would you do about that? Give me some thoughts. Peter, in his great righteousness, would say, "Hey, if you're going to do something wrong, you got to share it with me. You got to give me half." Okay. Wow. Okay. What would you do, and how would you do it? Let's say you can be you. If you're a elder at Mission Church, you can be you in this scenario. If you're just an attendee, if you've never been here before, you can be you in this. What would you do, and how would you do it? You would just judge me. Yeah, you would do nothing and just judge me internally. I like that. That's ask about it later. Yeah, what would you ask? What would you do?
Did you pay for that?
Did you pay? But you know. Yeah. But yeah, you'd find a way to talk to me about it later, and you'd have a different view of me, right? You would, yeah. Any other?
I just call you up there. Like, I just call you up.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so much harder later.
So much harder later. Celeste would be like, hey, man, are you stealing those? Pastor of Mission Church. Yeah. Yeah. Let's just address it head on. Yeah, sure. Any other thoughts?
Tell the manager,
sure. Yeah, like default to the authority in the room. Sure, that's valid. Yeah, okay. I'm going to change it up a little bit. What if it's not me, and it was somebody wearing that Target red polo? It was an employee of the store who did it. Then what? What would you do, and how would you do it? Joey's holding with tell the manager, and that's a solid option. Yeah. Any other? Does that change anything for any of you?
Is it shopping in their uniform?
Yeah. Shopping in their uniform. I know. I didn't think this through entirely, but you know they're an employee. Yeah.
Post about it on the internet.
You snap that. Boom. Yeah. At followers. Yeah. Everybody's going to. Yeah. There you go. Anybody else?
If I worked
there, I'd definitely say something. Yeah. Peter's a little more clear. If you worked there, he'd say something. If you didn't work there, not so sure. Elizabeth?
If I knew it was you, I'd react like Celeste.
Yeah. Maybe there's something I don't know here. Maybe I don't know the whole scenario. Sure. Yeah. Okay. Final scenario. It's a single mother, or appears to be a single mother with three kids, and the kids are begging for them, and they are like saying, like, please, mom, come on. Topps Chrome, come on. And she's like, no, we can't do it right now. And then the kids run off down the aisle, and she just takes three packs and whoop. What would you do? How would you do it? You might buy the packs for her. Oh. Yeah.
Turn the other cheek and not say anything.
Turn the other cheek and not say anything. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that?
They're already on camera.
They're already on camera. Yeah, would it? I don't know. Is it not still theft? Yeah. So reasoning with them more like as a fellow mother, is this really the right way to go about this? Yeah.
In this case, though, she's already told them no.
Right.
This is like bad parenting to give into them.
Yeah. Yeah, you might give them a talk about like what is good parenting. Do you notice the different approaches there though? Like the different gut responses you have based on who the person is and your perception of what they're going through, right? It's interesting. The reason for these proverbs today is actually the fact that I had submitted a question. So we took people's submissions this year, what we wanted wisdom on, and this is my question. So I decided to address my own question. And my question was one that I submitted on behalf of us all in a way, but it really is one of mine, and I wanted a chance to dig into the proverbs on the topic. And that was, you know, how do you deal with difficult people in your community? And as I thought about my own question, I thought, often what I hear when I hear people talk about somebody being difficult is a perception of something that is a sin, really, that they're engaging in, something that's not right somehow. and how to bring it up and how to deal with it and how long to deal with it and how often to deal with it and stuff like that. So I had in mind in the church, but I also had things in mind like between neighbors or in your workplace or even within your family. What do we do when people seem to do things that we don't think they ought to do and in ways that they ought not to do that, but we're in community with them? That's part of the reality. We can't get away with it without leaving our very community. How do we cope? So that's what we're really going to get into today. And that's going to require some defining, because if sin is kind of a factor in this, we're going to have to lay the groundwork on that. I think that needs to be done. We're going to go to these Proverbs, and we're going to wrestle with what seems to be a bit of a contradiction within the Proverbs. You can find a proverb that tells you, speak up directly and now, and you can find a proverb that tells you, don't say anything at all. You can find those. You can find ones that seem to say something in the middle. So we're going to wrestle with the Proverbs, and we're going to attempt to emerge from that a little bit more wise. So that's the plan. So what is sin? What is sin is probably one of the most repeated topics we've had here at Mission Church, but it's been a little bit. Probably one of the greatest hits of Mission Church is the what is sin conversation. It's one we need to remember, and the reason that I've taken so much time to work it out for us is because we tend to lump together a lot of ideas that are in the Bible under the word sin. You just heard me with the kids work out the idea that sin isn't just actions we do, even though that's what we're going to spend the majority of our time on. It's the whole state of the world after the fall. It's the fact that things aren't the way they're supposed to be. It's everything that's broken and imperfect. That all could be lumped under this big idea of sin. But there's other words that get lumped into it that I want to work out for us for a second. The first one is iniquity. Have you heard that word, iniquity? Sometimes gets, you know, lumped under sin. And if you notice when I said it, I didn't put an article in front of it. I didn't call it an iniquity or a iniquity. I just called it iniquity because that word is not so much about a specific action, but more about an internal orientation, an orientation that's off kilter in some respect. In wisdom literature, which we're studying for the year, we've noticed that there's a reference point for wisdom, and it's the fear of the Lord. That's the beginning of wisdom. It's the plumb line for wisdom. And in our day, of course, the most common reference point would not be the fear of the Lord. The most common in our culture would be the fear of myself. And what I mean by that is that I dare not offend myself or my self-perception. It really is a fear. It really is an allegiance. I must be true to myself. We're taught that from a very young age. But iniquity is in reference to God, the fear of the Lord. And it's a word for something like this. You could imagine this. This is a piece of lumber that's twisted, right? My dad used to be the driver for Grant Road Lumber, now known as Culinary Dropout, which used to be a big lumber yard here in Tucson. And he worked in the yard and he drove the trucks. And one of the perks of the job is we could get all the cull lumber for free, which is cull lumber is this, twisted lumber. And to use twisted lumber, you had to do a lot more work, right? You had to force it back into shape in order to make it useful. You would either lay it, you'd flip it, you'd lay it out differently, you'd try to get the sun to hit it another way, or you just forced it straight and then screwed it in and hope it hold. But I'm very familiar with this this kind of lumber. Lumber like this, there's a true form it's supposed to be in, and it's twisted. It's no longer in the shape it should be. And that's the word iniquity, that something within our hearts is not straight and true. It's no longer the way it should be. It's inclined in a different direction. Usually that direction is going to be toward the self. We're going to be crooked. That's where we get the word crook, right? He's a crook. Why? Because his motivations are not straight and true. They're crooked. That's what it means. Toward rebellion, away from God. Have you ever noticed, and I want you to think about your enemies, the people you just cannot comprehend, right? The people who just baffle you. Doesn't it seem like something within them is just not normal, not typical, not true, not reasonable? Yeah, a little off toward themselves, toward wrong motivations, be it money, power, cynicism, prestige, just not quite right. If you understand that feeling, of feeling that way about somebody, then you understand the word iniquity. But here's the test, right? Are you more aware of the iniquity that they carry than you are of the iniquity that you carry? It's a good thing to consider. There might be something twisted about that. The next word is transgression. Transgression means to cross the line. Our family example of this is how I taught our daughter about curbs. Some of you have heard this 20 times now. Thank you for showing up for number 21. Our rule when Abby was little was if you get to the curb, you need to stop at the curb. That was one of the boundary lines we had. And you need to look at me, was my rule, and I will make sure you're good to cross the road. So if you get to a curb, look at me, and we'll make sure you're good to cross the road. And now, she's human. So what do you think she tended to do? Go, says Roland. Well, you know, there's types of humans. Some types of people, right? If you tell them, don't get near that curb, they will be, they'll stay 20 feet away from it, right? It's just, I don't want to go anywhere near anything that could have any kind of problem at all. That's one type. And then there's another type, which is more typical of our family. And that is, I'm going to get to that curb. I'm going to hang over it. I'm going to dangle the foot, but I won't quite, you know? And she, and to her credit, she would stop after going as far as humanly possible, right? And one time the car blew by at about 30 miles an hour as she stood right there at the curb. And I looked at her and went, yeah, see? Most of the time it didn't, in which point she would say, see, you know. Of course, I made that boundary because, not because she would always die if she crossed a curb, but because I wanted her to learn to not just trust her own intuition, but to stop and look carefully, to protect herself, to save herself from pain. I wanted her to learn and grow and become a good thinker. And I wanted her to learn from me in those early years. Have you ever been given a rule like that? You know, don't go outside of these boundaries. Don't go past this point. Have you ever prescribed a rule like that to others? If you don't think you deal with any of these rules, you must not drive. You must not live in structures made by building codes. You must not be thriving due to a generally organized society that has all kinds of transgression rules all over the place, right? Why is it that you didn't just drive down the center of the road or decide to drive on the left side when you came here? Why is it that when the light turned red, you stopped? It's because you follow rules that create boundaries, right? And if you understand that, then you understand transgression. And transgression in regard to fearing the Lord is to look at the laws of God and use them as some of those boundaries and the laws of our society. Here's kind of a way that God's law works in the Bible. It's pretty, there's a lot there. But here's my little hand sketch. Pretty good, I think. Kind of some two big ideas. Love the Lord your God. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Love God, love others. In Proverbs 3, we call that love and faithfulness. We read, that was one of the ones that Vi read to us, which it says, never let loyalty and kindness leave you. Tie them around your neck as a reminder. Write them deep within your heart. Love and faithfulness. I meant loyalty and kindness. But when you read that section from Proverbs, if you're familiar with Deuteronomy in the Old Testament, it's like it's the language of the law. Tie the law around your neck as a reminder. Write it deep within your heart. And it's saying loyalty to God, faithfulness, kindness to others. It's law language. And so from the idea of love God and love others, hang the Ten Commandments. You should have no other gods, no idols, things like that are definite, you know, more specific ways to love God, love others. A great example of that would be do not murder. It's difficult to love someone while killing them. I've noticed from what I've heard. And then there's further laws that even build those out further. What does it mean not to murder? Well, there's going to be dozens and dozens of laws that specify when is something accidental? When is it on purpose? There's a guilt involved no matter what. So the laws of God, those boundary laws, all in reference to the fear of the Lord are teaching us what a transgression is exactly. So transgression is when God makes a boundary and we cross it and we stop living for and in respect to the fear of the Lord. We stop living for the sake of others. Often it's because we're focused on ourselves. Anybody here ever deal with any of that? You ever struggle with any of that to any degree? As a young minister, there was when I was in my early 20s, one of the main evangelism trainings was D. James Kennedy, Evangelism Explosion, it was called. And it's feels pretty antiquated these days. But he had one illustration that I still think is pretty good. It's pretty simple. He would just say to people, he would say something to the effect of, look, most of us don't think about how much we sin, but imagine if sin was anything that wasn't right, anything that wasn't perfect, and imagine you were really, really good and you only sinned 3 times a day, you know, and we were to keep a book of all your sins. And if you sinned, you know, 3 times a day, you'd have about 1,000 sins in a year. And, you know, how old are you? You know, I'm 43, 43,000. That's if I just pulled off 3 sins a day. That's quite a bit. It's not looking so good if I'm supposed to be a really good person, right? And I would usually point out to them, and you know, if I were like doing this evangelism strategy, I would say to somebody, "Look, if I'm being totally honest with you, I'm not even telling you about Jesus for the right reasons. I'm currently in sin. Like, I'm doing this because I want you to think I'm really convincing. I'm doing this because I want to do the right thing with my life. I want to feel really productive for God. And that's not even as loving to you as it ought to be. So there's another one of my sins. Add them up. It's a lot, right? Yeah, it's kind of devastating. And then there's the word we're most familiar with for sin, which is sin, which is the old archery term. I'll use darts. Here for sin is anything that's not dead center, that perfect dead center, right? If you're playing darts and you try to hit the bullseye, which normally you do, or whatever section you're trying to hit, right? That's what you're trying to do. If you're taking the game seriously, and if you miss, do you get credit for a bullseye? No. That would undermine the game. It would mess up the game. Well, that's the word sin. It's anything that isn't perfect is imperfect. It's a miss, plain and simple. That's the definition of the word sin. Anything that's not exactly what it ought to be. And that's absolutely devastating to our ego because it means this. We don't even have to intend to sin to sin. It includes the idea of iniquity and transgression, right? It infers that maybe we have wrong motives. It infers the idea that we might break the rules. Like, I mean, maybe if you're playing darts and you have a messed up arm, you know, it's like, well, I couldn't throw it because my arm's messed up. Right, that's your iniquity causing you to have a problem. Well, my shot was disqualified because I crossed the line. Yep, that was transgression. And then on top of all that, you just missed. It's devastating by definition, right? So why do I bring all this up? Well, if we live in a community together, do you think we're going to avoid sinning against each other? The way I've just defined this? It's going to happen all the time. I know there's this misconception out there that I just want to, I don't know, tweet this everywhere, please. People think if I go to church, I'll find a group of people that aren't sinning against each other. What? No chance. Church is not a place that's free from sin. It's not. In fact, church is a community based on a couple core things, but one of them is simply this. It admits its sin. Church is where we admit sin and our need to receive grace. But it's not free from it. Church is a place where you seek to learn the way of walking in a hope that can only come beyond ourselves because we are steeped in sin and can't get out. So when we think about dealing with sin in another person, we must immediately ask this question. What about me? For example, in my confrontation of this person, could I sin? In my confrontation of this person, could I miss the fear of the Lord myself? Could I be quick to speak and slow to listen? Could I fail to understand? Could I manipulate? Could I maintain control either through avoiding confrontation or by confronting immediately? Could my truth-telling directly hide my insecurity or discomfort that could come from a longer and meaningful conversation? We have to ask those kind of questions because every time we show up in relationship, there's two sinners at the table. That's the way it is. Not just one. So to ask how do I deal with difficult people begs the question, how do I want people to deal with difficult me? In the Bible, it talks about God's people and their attempts to do the right thing. When we attempt to do the right thing, this is how it's phrased in the book of Isaiah 64:6. All of our righteous acts, our best, most godly acts, are like this before God, like filthy rags. And that doesn't mean God thinks we stink. That's just a statement of that's what they're like. And when God receives them, that's what he receives. And he takes them and he uses them. And that's sweet. Our English translators, by the way, stop short of that, the meaning of that word filthy rags, because we think something you just cleaned the kitchen with, right? The academic translation would be a soiled garment. That still sort of misses it, right? The Saturday Night Live vulgar version would be that. Yeah, oops, I crap my pants. The Hebrew, the Hebrew for soiled garment, that's what it is. It's kind of gross, right? That like feels wrong to even put it in the Bible. That's when we do our best. What God takes and he cleans up and he uses is like a soiled garment. Okay. So when we call out another person for their sin, we have to understand we're offering at our best a soiled garment. We can't help but sin ourselves in God's eyes. So what do we do? Does that mean we just make it all relative? Well, that's definitely not what the Bible says. So the wisdom literature is given to help us think this through, to parse this out. So into the wisdom literature. Wisdom literature uses strategies we don't often expect from the Bible or get from a TED Talk, which is we're supposed to get answers through a process. We've been calling wisdom literature hard candy, which means that it takes time. It takes work to discern its flavor. It's meant to cause you to wrestle, reflect, and seek the input of others. Wisdom literature uses methods like contradiction or parallelism to make you think and work to get an answer. So we're going to do a little bit of that right now. I'm going to start with Proverbs that seem to contradict or speak against one another. Let's look at 27:5 and 19:11 for a second. An open rebuke is better than hidden love, right? That seems to lend toward rebuke now and fast, right? Open rebuke. I tend to think of that as, you know, I don't know why I add fast to it, but it feels like it, just openly. And then the second one, 19:11, says sensible people control their temper. They earn respect by overlooking wrongs. Okay? Open rebuke or overlooking wrongs, right? Do you call it out or pretend it never happened? Well, we're going to take a closer look, especially at 27:5. And I skipped part of what we read, what Vi read earlier, to make this point. 27:5 cannot be understood without 27:6. And this is what you need to be careful with using the Bible, with using a proverb. Sometimes you can cherry pick a piece and miss something. And sometimes you have to dig a little bit because this one also requires some insight into the Hebrew. So 27:5 and 6 goes this way. An open rebuke is better than hidden love. Wounds from a sincere friend are better than many kisses from an enemy. Now that's a parallelism, which means this. It means the first line is going to be the more obscure. The second line is going to shed light on it. And here, a key thing that we don't see in English, and really not many translations draw this out, but the word love repeats in the parallelism. We read the word friend, but actually the second line would read more like wounds from a sincere lover. And that's not romantic, but read it as one who loves you, who sincerely loves you. Okay? So open rebuke is better than hidden love, but wounds from someone who sincerely love you are better than kisses from an enemy. How does that second line illuminate the first in your mind? Give me some feedback there. How does the second line clarify the first line?
There's a built relationship.
A built relationship, yeah. To be someone who loves or is known to love or have a sincere love infers some kind of deep knowledge, right? Yeah. 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 Yeah, maybe the relational context is more important than the specific words, yeah.
This is about when somebody rebukes you, not when you're rebuking somebody else. Yeah,
it feels like actually more about the feeling a person gets from being rebuked as opposed to telling you when you get to rebuke, which is often where we go with it. Yeah, yeah, it's good. Yeah, it seems things like that, effective, you know, rebuke comes from one who loves. And an enemy, notice, is an enemy whether they rebuke or kiss, right? It's better than kisses from an enemy, but the enemy is an enemy no matter what. At least in a way, their rebuke isn't confusing. Flattery is confusing. The rebuke of an enemy, you're like, yeah, you're an enemy. I get it. Flattery from an enemy is confusing. But rebuke from a friend, one who loves you, that sort of stands out as the unique thing in that proverb, right? We're going to look at four more quickly here. 25:11-12. Timely advice is lovely. like golden apples in a silver basket. To one who listens, valid criticism is like a gold earring or other gold jewelry. 28:23. In the end, people appreciate honest criticism far more than flattery. 9:7-9. Anyone who rebukes a mocker will get an insult in return. Anyone who corrects the wicked will get hurt. So don't bother correcting mockers. They will only hate you. But correct the wise and they will love you. Instruct the wise and they will be even wiser. Teach the righteous and they will learn even more. 15:1-2. A gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge appealing, but the mouth of a fool belches out foolishness. We're going to look at the last one there, 15:1-2, another parallelism, where the second line clarifies the first. In it, gentle is compared to harsh, and both of these words are words that are meant to relate to pain, the pain that they cause. So you know that, like, you know, a gentle, if you're in pain, don't you prefer to be treated with gentleness? Like if you go into the doctor and your arm hurts, you'd like them to be gentle with your arm. That would be ideal. But a harsh response is one that brings more pain. And we know, most of us know, that a lot of times harshness doesn't just cause pain, but it comes from pain, right? If you're afraid, if you've been hurt, your chances of being harsh are high, and you can inflict pain back. It's like the wounded dog metaphor. We have literally one in our home, Benji, our old buddy Benji. He was an abused dog. We think he was probably kicked a lot because he would have issues with people's feet and their shoes, and he would growl and he would bite feet, especially men. He bit me a number of times, and normally my feet, but he would just get really aggressive. And he's changed over time. It's taken a long time. But when we adopted our little puppy, Leo, his default is gentleness. He would just walk up to you and collapse in your lap and trust you because he didn't have evidence to the contrary. So he wasn't harsh because he hadn't been treated harshly. And I think people are often very similar. Often we hurt because we're hurt. We sin because we've been sinned against. And that's not an excuse, but it's something we need to think about. Why am I so harsh? We need to think about that. But the second line of the parallelism is the surprising one. It makes us think the most. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge appealing, but the mouth of a fool belches out foolishness. And this is where, you know, and I said, kids, you get to think about belching. This proverb invites you to think about two things you wouldn't normally pair with one another. Appealing knowledge. So, okay, have you ever heard, like, I don't know, a presentation from somebody who's really, really wise and really, really smart, and you think when you hear it, I want to hear more of that. I want to be more like that. I want to go to school where they teach. I want to do that. And then if you heard someone just walking down the street let out a giant belch, these two are compared for us. We get to talk about this for a second. What is the difference between hearing appealing knowledge and a belch? What's the difference between the experience first? Why do you think godly people in the Proverbs gave us this comparison? What's the difference in experience?
Stark contrast.
Becky says there is a stark contrast. Yeah. Yeah. The difference in experience.
One enriches your life and the other one repulses you.
One enriches your life and the other repulses you. Yeah. Demet, you were pump faking there, yeah.
The wise knowledge, you're listening for it, you're expecting it. The belch is unexpected; it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, the wise knowledge, you're like tuned in, you're expecting it, expecting more. The belch is like alarming, right? Like, yeah, what was that? Yeah, where do they come from? How are they developed? Where do they come from? How are they developed? Appealing knowledge and a big, loud belch. This is a weird thing to talk about. Yeah. Think about that. Where do they come from? How are they developed? This is important to the meaning of this text.
The appealing knowledge is from the heart and the mind, and the belch is from the stomach.
Yeah. The appealing knowledge is from the heart, the mind. The belch is from the stomach, from the gut. There's probably something meaningful to that distinction. Yeah. Yeah, I think about appealing knowledge is usually something you realize this took a lot of premeditated effort. Anybody can let out a belch, right? Doesn't come from careful, crafting. Yeah. Yeah. It seems all of those texts we read, and this one especially, there's a theme, and it would be something like time and development. Timely advice was one of the parts of the proverb. Well, how do you make sure it's timely? To make sure that something is given on time requires reflection and planning and understanding. That's how it becomes timely, right? There was the one that said, in the end, people appreciate honest criticism. And it takes work to make sure that your criticism is honest, but it also means that in the end, people will appreciate it. It means you're allowing a lot of time for somebody. I mean, that might mean that you give the honest criticism and it's 10 years later that you hear back from them, you were right about that. And it doesn't get to just be this flash in the pan, you fixed it moment. Another way of saying that would be don't bank on immediate results. Honest criticism takes its time. There's the one that said don't rebuke a mocker but instruct the wise. Well, how do you know which one you're dealing with? You have to take some time. You have to discern. You have to maybe ask somebody else how they received their feedback. It takes time and development.
And experience.
Absolutely. Okay, are we emerging with anything from all this seeming contradiction to end? In my mind, as I worked through this, I thought it actually doesn't feel contradictory at all when I get to the end of it. It doesn't feel like a question of do I speak up, do I call somebody out, or do I let it slide. It feels like the whole process was oriented toward how to do both well, right? How to discern when and how to do it. We likely do need to have hard conversations we don't want to have. I think some of these proverbs are encouraging us, like, and often, what we want to do? We want to call out people we don't know because then we don't have to deal with them. But the proverbs tend to say, call out the friend, call out your friend. Like when you all were given the scenario of me stealing the baseball cards, you should talk to me. You should talk to the elders of the church. Like, yes, you know me. You're in my, yes, of all people, you should talk to me. Right? The closer we are, the more we should do it. And often that's when it's hardest for us. And I think these proverbs encourage us. If you're close, if you're in relationship, then the answer is yes. And do it with knowledge and with real, genuine love. Right? We likely do need to give time that we don't want to devote to these things because they're important. We do likely need to stop ourselves from speaking too soon or too much or overloading a person with too many criticisms they can't handle. We need to know a person and what's going to be effective to do this well. There's probably people we need to choose not to give any feedback to because they're really not interested in it. Either because it won't work or maybe even because the feedback I want to give is more about me and getting something off my chest than about taking care of them. And if that's where you are, you should at least wait. At least wait. But the Proverbs, most of all, want us to slow down and consider and something should happen to us along the way as we slow down. What's most important is the process that we go through. It's not about whether we end up calling the person out or not. It's the process that we go through as we discern how to give an honest, loving critique along with mercy, or choose not to throw our pearls before swine. That process is exactly where God wants us to be. Now, pearls before swine. That line comes from Jesus, right? The wisdom of God, see, didn't just come to us in Proverbs or sayings. It's not just about us working it out in our minds. It's not just about theory. It's leading us to a real need and a real remedy. And the uniqueness of the Christian story is that the wisdom of God, the love of God, came to us in person. So Jesus, one day on the mountainside, Sermon on the Mount, he was dosing out hard candy to people to get them thinking. And one of the things he said was effectively, don't entrust your fine jewelry to the pig. Don't entrust your fine jewelry to the pigs, right? And people had to wrestle with that. What does he mean by that? And right before that, he'd been talking about judgment and how to not be hypocritical. But then here he's talking about what you offer, the wisdom you have to offer to people. And he said, look, don't entrust it. Don't entrust your fine jewelry to pigs. Which must mean something to the sense of discern if the person will, can, or has the wherewithal to listen to you. Can they even digest this? Discern that. Discern that. And here's Jesus delivering us wisdom that takes thought. But it doesn't just take thought. It like takes a lot of trust in God and the fear of the Lord, because sometimes I think when we want to throw out that critique or we want to, you know, entrust our fine jewelry to the pigs, our fine, wonderful opinions to everybody out there who's stupid and wrong, it takes a lot of trust in God, because it means if we don't do it, say we withhold it, those fools out there, those morons out there might exist without knowing what I think about them. And that's scary, because they might never change. And maybe I won't be truly seen for how godly I am. Right? If they heard what I thought, what I think, surely they would change. Just like I would change if they told me everything they thought about me. Isn't that how it works? If your enemy told you everything they thought about you, do you think you'd become like them real quick? Probably not. Yeah, probably not. Isn't it interesting? I mean, maybe Jesus knows what he's talking about. Maybe he's teaching us how to live not just a peaceful life, but an effective one. But Jesus didn't come just reaffirming the wisdom of the Proverbs. He gives us more. He lives it out right in front of us. People watched and wrote about his life. It's the story we live within as Christians. Jesus walked with his disciples who were in need of so much, and he patiently applied honest criticism to love. He was a friend. He was a lover to them. He loved them. Right? He spent years with his disciples. By the end of his life, they still didn't completely understand what he was trying to teach them. They weren't like him, right? And that whole story, I think when you read the Gospels, Abby's little children's Bible story book opened with something that said, some people think the Bible is a book full of heroes, but it's not. It's full of people who made a lot of mistakes, actually, right? And when you read the Gospels, really, just at the core of who they are, like, you don't come away going, the 12 disciples are awesome. You come away going, the 12 disciples, how are they still here? Like, they're kind of a mess, right? James and John, you know, they want to be the greatest. And they even get their mom to advocate for it, that they can be on the right and left of Jesus, you know, in his kingdom. And Jesus is like, well, there's going to be two people on my right and left in my great moment, and they're going to be on crosses. He didn't say that. But you know, he's thinking like, you really want to be on my right and my left? You don't know what you're talking about. But he says to them, he says, it's not for me to grant who's on my right and my left, but here's the deal in my kingdom. Whoever wants to be the greatest gets to be the servant of all. And they walked away and they went, huh? That doesn't sound great. And I'm confused. Peter is going to be Jesus' great defender, right? When Jesus is in danger and all their hopes and plans are falling apart, Jesus is like, good thing I came prepared with this sword. And he hacks and probably meant to take off the guy's head, but he takes off his ear. And Jesus says, no. We don't do that. If you think you're going to live by the sword, you're actually going to die by the sword. Peter's thinking Jesus is going to look at him and go, yes, you know, throw me another. Ha! You know, it's going to be like a total pirate scene out there in the Garden of Gethsemane. That's what Peter's thinking, you know. He thinks they're all just going to be like, ha, ha. Instead, Peter heals the guy. What? How is this going to bring about a kingdom, right? And then Judas, of course, walks into that garden and that whole crazy scene. What's he do? Gives him a kiss. Gives Jesus a kiss. Right? And Jesus says, wow, you would betray the Son of Man with a kiss. And in all the face of all that complexity, Jesus never neglects the fear of the Lord or to love the people involved. I can't remember one time Jesus just got up on a soapbox and gave them, a tongue lashing. Kept teaching them. But he also confronted things. He was a good friend. He didn't just let people be in it for the power. I think when he looked at Judas and said, you would betray the Son of Man with a kiss, I think Judas could probably see just the absolute heartbreak in his eyes that he would be betrayed like that. He probably felt it. It's not that he didn't show up. See, Jesus doesn't just show us how it's done. He did what we cannot do because our efforts are tainted by sin. Just like all those disciples, we're the same. As we try to walk with Jesus, we have all these misguided reasons for the things that we do. And Jesus is always correcting us, bringing us back to the path, letting us see the sorrow in his eyes, telling us, no, that's not what we're doing here. He is so patient. If we ever call out the sin in others, it must be as a fellow sinner who knows how patient Jesus is being with us right now and how generous. And if we own that identity as a community, people for whom Jesus has much mercy, we can have the power of God at work within us to help us walk with others and offer the same. We're going to move into our final three rhythms of worship, where we're going to contemplate that a little bit more. We do three things here: confess, receive, and offer. Confession is a time where we come before God and we can confess a few different things. Sin is one. We can confess faith. We can confess our needs to God. But it's asking. It's coming to God and asking for what we need. Today, if there's a... I would say if it's really hard for you to see the way that you contribute to the problem, it'd probably be a good time to ask God, like, what's it like to be patient with me? You could ask that. If you're hyper aware of that, maybe just ask God to like remind you about how much he loves you and he's a friend to you in Jesus. Perhaps you need to think about somebody who... Yeah, it's time to talk to them, but you're scared and you need to move into that, but it feels really like it's going to be a bit much. And just ask God to help you to do it the right way and to guide you by his Spirit. I need help, God. I confess my need for you. I'm trying to figure this out on my own, whatever that looks like. You'll have 2 minutes of silence to have that kind of time. Second is receive. We come up to the Lord's table, acknowledging that we come to Jesus. There's that whole record book of sins thing. So it's like in the righteousness department, I'm not good. I need I need a righteous Savior. I need one who's walked in my place. I need one who's done this right on my behalf. And Jesus is saying at the table, he's saying, yes, I know who you are. I know what you're like. And I love you. And I've set this table for you. And I've redeemed you by my blood. On the night that Jesus was betrayed, he broke bread. And when he broke it, he said, this is my body broken for the forgiveness of many. And what he's saying is that substitutionary atonement thing we talked about with the kids. Like, my death on the cross means you can stand and you can keep trying. And you can have faith, and you can actually have the power of my Spirit within you to keep living this life, even though you're disqualified. I take your filthy rags and I redeem them, and I work through your attempts, and I do good and beautiful things because of the work of the cross. He also took the cup and he said, this is my blood of a new covenant, a new promise shed for the forgiveness of many. And every time you drink of it, remember me. And he said, surely I will not drink of this again until I drink it anew in my kingdom with you, which means that there's a new kingdom that's emerging in this world, and that God's actually going to take the effects of sin and undo them. Things will be made right. We will be made right. The world will be made right. So it's worth it to keep trying and walking through the difficult things of this life, because all the sad things are coming untrue. So when we come and receive from him, we're receiving that hope that helps us to keep moving forward in community. And then offer, as you leave the table and walk around, you'll notice the lit up window back there. And we do the traditional offering of giving, of monetary giving, which is super important to us functioning as a church and a community and supporting our missionaries and such. And that's very important back there. But the second thing is that glass window, which is meant to be a place where you think about something a little more tangible that you can offer. So today I thought about, I would love you to think of a word. When you think, how do I want someone else to address my sins, and you come up with a word for that, maybe write it on that glass, just as a way of remembering, because that's probably how to offer it to others, right? How do I want it to be addressed in me? How can I offer it to others? Think of one word for that and offer that to others throughout the week. So I'm going to say a quick prayer, and there will be a 2-minute silence before Jules and the band come up and we receive the Lord's Supper together. So let's pray. Father, it's good to reflect on all of these things. While sin is not a wonderful topic, it's actually it's a comfort to remember that we're all in the same boat. It's good for us to remember that we're not better than anybody else, and that it's your mercy by which we stand. It's good to reflect on how, when we think of all this conflict resolution stuff, that you're the master of it all. You've taught us, and it's the way you've treated us. And we're really grateful for your mercy, for the cross, for the way you lived your life. We want to follow you. So teach us to truly follow after you, to become wise as you were wise, and to honor you. So lead us now as we bring our confessions before you.